Good afternoon, everyone. I don't know about you, but I am so thankful to finally be in November. Past the awful celebration that is Halloween, and I know you all are too. I mean, just thinking about that though, how many of you were tempted to go trick-or-treating this year? Just raise your hands. Oh, sorry. Did you want to decorate your house with spider webs? You know, our house is right now, but I assure you they're all natural. I'm hopefully going to be able to clean those up tomorrow. Did you even for a moment urge to glorify in any of the sick things that Halloween offers? I don't know anyone that has come into the church who has struggled with celebrating Halloween. Now, sure, we may like to put on costumes now and then, but the actual practice and celebration of Halloween is so far removed from God's way of life that we really don't feel much temptation from it. So what's Satan's point? On one hand, Halloween is a vivid reminder that we really want nothing to do with Satan's way of life or the things that he glories in. So why does he push it on us each year? Halloween is a big lie, and I promise my message is not about Halloween. It's just kind of a good introduction. Halloween is a big lie, and we reject it. But often, big, bold lies act as smokescreens for smaller, more subtle lies. And if we aren't careful, we may unwittingly buy into them. Just as an example, every time I'm reading and I'm reading Christ's words, a lot of times I picture him as he's speaking, right? And what is the image that we all so often bring into our minds? It's the image that we know isn't right. And I try to make a conscious effort to shove that image out of my mind because I know, you know, he wasn't blonde hair with, you know, long hair and all that stuff. But so often, that's the lie that's pushed on us so many times that that's the image that comes to mind. There are several lies that Satan wants us to believe regarding spirit beings and spiritual life. Now, for us as Christians, I believe that's his main goal. For Christians who reject Halloween, he wants to influence how we view what it means being a spirit being. He knows he won't get us on the big lie, but he may trick us into quietly accepting the lies that he tells about our goal, our prize for living God's way of life, becoming eternal spirit beings in God's family. Satan makes much use of Hollywood and the power of the air to broadcast lies directly into our living rooms. And many of these lies come to us directly from TV shows and movies and things like that. So, I have a few that I'd like to go over today. The first lie that Satan, I think, wants us to believe is that Satan himself and the demons are scary looking. Now, if you were to picture what Satan looks like, and I please don't spend much time doing that sort of thing, but if you were, you know, it's easy to picture this fierce-looking thing, red tail, breathing fire and such. If you've ever seen Thor Ragnarok, you know, it's easy to picture Satan as the character at the end of the movie that destroys Thor's homeworld. And it's this massive, fiery, red monster with horns, and it's easy to picture that. Well, what does the Bible say? Well, it would seem the Bible kind of supports the idea. It actually refers to him as a serpent, that great dragon of old. Let's turn to Revelation 12. You can read about this in Revelation 12. And pick it up in verse 7. And war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought. But they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. And he was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. So Satan is cast out of heaven. He's called the dragon multiple times. Now, the cool thing about the New Testament is that it's written in Greek. It was written in Greek. Hebrew is a difficult language. It wasn't nearly as widely spoken as Greek. And we can take Greek words and see how they were used in literature in ancient times to get a more a better understanding of what was meant. So the Greek word here used for dragon is not a big shocker, it's drakon. There's a Wikipedia article titled Dragons in Greek Mythology, and it describes a slew of different dragons that can be found in Greek mythology and gives their names and attributes about them. But it has this one quote that's rather interesting. The Greek dragon was far more associated with poisonous spit or breath than the modern Western dragon, though fiery breath is still attested in a few myths. Poisonous spit, poisonous breath, fiery breath. The main takeaway from the word dragon here isn't physical appearance, but what comes out of his mouth. If we continue on, in verse 10, then I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of our Christ has come. For the accuser of our brethren, who accused them before God day and night, has been cast down. He is an accuser. God's purpose here in this scripture isn't to try to describe what Satan looks like, but who and what he is. The entire book of Revelation is a vision. It's metaphorical and symbolic. Satan doesn't look like a dragon, but he acts like one. Satan breathes poison and fire, destruction. He's a liar and the father of it. And that's one of the most important things for us to remember, that Satan is a liar. Okay, that's great and all, but what do spirit beings actually look like? Well, so you see, the next lie Satan tries to push on us is that spirit beings are kind of ghostly figures. Well, let's turn over to Ezekiel 28, see what does the Bible have to say about this. You can go to Ezekiel 28, and we'll pick it up in verse 13. Speaking of Satan, verse 13, you were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering, the sardis, the topaz, and diamond, the beryl, onyx, and jasper, sapphire, turquoise, and emerald with gold. The workmanship of your timbrels and pipes was prepared for you on the day that you were created. Let's get down to verse 16. By the abundance of your trading, you became filled with violence and sin. Therefore, I cast you as a profane thing out of the mountain of God and destroyed you, a covering cherub, from the midst of the fiery stones. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor, and I cast you to the ground. I laid you before kings that they may gaze at you. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. Now, as an angel in God's kingdom, Lucifer was beautiful, just as all spirit beings God created. Was he any more beautiful than the angels of God, the other angels of God? He certainly seemed to think so. He looked at himself and didn't lament for his weak, frail, or sad-looking appearance. He looked at the beauty that God had created him with and became proud and glorified himself. He glorified himself, this created being, rather than his God, his creator. Now again, we see in verse 16 that he was a cherub. And if we turn back to Ezekiel 1, we can actually read about cherubs and what they look like. It's going back now to Ezekiel chapter 1, and we'll pick it up in verse 5. So here Ezekiel is being given a vision from the throne of God. Also from within it came the likeness of four living creatures. And this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man. Each one had four faces, and each one had four wings. Their legs were straight, and the soles of their feet were like soles of calves' feet. They sparkled like the color of burnished bronze. The hands of a man were under their wings on their four sides, and each of the four had faces and wings. And the wings touched one another, and the creatures did not turn when they went, but they went straight forward. As for the likeness of their faces, each had the face of a man. Each of the four had the face of a lion on the right side. Each of the four had the face of an ox on the left side. And each of the four had the face of an eagle. Thus were their faces. Their wings were stretched upward, two wings of each one touched one another, and two covered their bodies. And each one went straight forward. They went where the Spirit wanted them to go, and they did not turn when they went. Continuing on, and as for their likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, like the appearance of torches going back and forth among the living creatures. The fire was bright, and out of the fire went lightning, and the living creatures ran back and forth, an appearance like a flash of lightning. There's no room here in this description for things like weak or shadowy or ghostly. These are powerful, awe-inspiring creatures. And Ezekiel was just struggling to find words to describe what he was seeking, what he was seeing. And this is what Satan was. In 2 Corinthians 11, we don't need to turn there, but Paul defended himself against false teachers who were pretending to be the apostles of Christ. And he said, it's no wonder, it's no stretch of the imagination that people can put on a face and appear to be apostles of God because Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. Isaiah 14 and verse 12 tells us that his name was Lucifer and that he was the son of the morning. And Lucifer means the morning star or the light bringer. So not only are they not these shallow, ghostly figures, but we also can't tell the difference between the righteous and fallen angels just based on their appearance. They all look absolutely magnificent to see. We can't distinguish them by the way they look, but by what they are saying, as we brought out in the first point. That's how we can tell the difference. Are they speaking truth, or are they speaking lies? Now this leads us into the next lie that they want to push, and that's that we should be afraid of them. Satan wants us to be afraid of him. Movies and TV shows often show people just terrified of spirit beings and what they might do to them. Why would they want us to be afraid? Let's turn over to 1 John. Go to 1 John chapter 4. And we'll pick it up in verse 17. Now love has been perfected among us in this, that we may have boldness in the day of judgment. Because as he is, so are we in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves torment. But he who fears has not been made perfect in love. We love him because he first loved us. Fear means we have a lack of love, a lack of faith. Now, it's it's reasonable to have fears. So that's not what I mean. But love casts out fear. Well, how? Well, because we love God, because we realize that he first loved us. And out of that love for us, he protects us and places on us a seal of protection, a hedge around us. He limits what Satan and the demons have the power to do. When we realize how much God loves us, there's isn't any place left for fear of torment, and that in turn fuels our love for God. Satan wants us to be afraid, to diminish that bond that we have with God. We must focus on the love that God has for us and not allow anyone or anything to make us afraid. Now, spirit beings have incredible power, but who is it that grants them that power? God. Satan wants us to be afraid of him, of being granted power, instead of God, the one who grants power. So when he makes us fearful of him, he takes away a measure of our love and trust in God. And further, they want us to be afraid because that's how they feel. Have you ever thought about how they, Satan and the demons, are the ones that are fearful? Bullies often act the way they do because of their own fears and insecurities. And Satan and the demons know that their fate is everlasting torment. We just read here in verse 18, fear involves torment. they only have a short time, and they will be locked up. They are powerful beings, but they won't be able to do anything with that power. They will be left to themselves, tormented by their own perverse minds. They are afraid. Turn over to Matthew chapter 8. Matthew chapter 8 and verse 28. We have this story of two men. Matthew 8 and verse 28. When he, Christ, had come to the other side of the country of the Gergesenes, there he met him two demon-possessed men coming out of the tombs, exceedingly fierce, so that no one could pass that way. And they suddenly cried out, saying, "What have we to do with you, Jesus, Son of God? Have you come to torment us before the time?" They want us to feel the way they feel, afraid. Don't be afraid of them, but fear God with proper fear, reverent, humble, godly fear. And the next thing that spirit beings, or that Satan wants us to believe, spirit beings can be turned away or controlled through words or physical things. That's another lie. There's this movie that we have, I'm sure you all have probably seen. It's called Megamind. It's a kid's show about these two babies that crash on Earth from other worlds, and they're almost immediately in competition with each other. And the main character becomes the villain, Megamind, and the other becomes the superhero. And they spend years, just as they grow up, fighting each other and having all these different battles, until the superhero just kind of gets tired of it. He's like, "Meh, I'm tired of doing this," you know? So the villain sets up this laser, and he's going to kill it's a kid's show. He sets up a laser, he's going to kill the superhero, and says, "Oh, you fiend, you found my one weakness, copper." Copper, of all things. He pretends like he can't escape. "Oh no, not copper. This is it." Really? So this whole time your weakness was copper? You know? Sometimes I think, you know, Satan likes to push this idea that, you know, he and the demons have this major weakness, right? Well, it's not, their weakness isn't any physical thing or any word, or it isn't copper, garlic, or crosses, or any one of the myriad of things that people have been led to believe will protect them. There are no words, phrases, or physical objects that hold any sort of power over spiritual beings. They tell these lies to obscure what their weakness actually is. Turn to Acts chapter 19. Acts chapter 19. Pick it up in verse 13. Do words have any basis whatsoever? And then some, verse 13, then some of the itinerant Jewish exorcists took it upon themselves to call the name of the Lord Jesus over those who had evil spirits, saying, "We exorcise you by Jesus whom Paul preaches." And there were seven sons of Sceva, a Jewish chief priest, who did so. And the evil spirit answered and said, "Jesus I know, and Paul I know, but who are you?" Then the man in whom the evil spirit was leapt upon them, overpowered them, prevailed against them, so that they fled out of that house naked and wounded. The words had no impact over that evil spirit. The words are just a breath, they're a vapor. The words have no impact. The impact of those words comes from calling upon the power of God, asking God to take action, to protect, to heal, and to drive out darkness. It's the power of God that matters, not the words. You could say these words in any language that you like, but they only work when you have the faith and the close relationship with God for him to hear us. Go back up just a couple of verses in verse 11. Something interesting here too. Now God worked unusual miracles by the hands of Paul, so that even handkerchiefs or aprons were brought from his body to the sick, and the diseases left them, and evil spirits went out of them. Was it in the handkerchief? Was it the handkerchief that healed? This is something that we still do today. When we can't meet with a minister of God in person to be anointed, we ask for an anointed cloth to be sent. That cloth doesn't have any power. It's not a charm. The cloth and the oil in it, on it, are symbols of the promise that God has made to us. We're asking for healing in faith, knowing that God will fulfill that promise to heal us. Faith is the key. Faith in the being who has the true power. All spirit beings are powerful, but God is all powerful. God is the one who grants the power and has allowed their power to continue for a short time. Through faith, we can call on God to override them and drive them away. Look over here again in Matthew chapter 17. Matthew chapter 17 and verse 14. And when they had come to the multitude, a man came to him, kneeling down to him and saying, "Lord, have mercy on my son, for he's an epileptic and he suffers severely, for he often falls into the fire and into the water. So I brought him to your disciples, but they could not cure him." Was it because they didn't say the right thing? Then Jesus answered, verse 17, and said, "O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I bear with you? Bring him here to me." And Jesus rebuked the demon, and it came out of him, and the child was cured from that very hour. Then the disciples came in to Jesus privately and said, "Why could we not cast it out?" Verse 20, Jesus said to them, "Because of your unbelief. For surely I say to you, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. However, this kind does not go out except by prayer and fasting." It wasn't because they didn't say the right thing. Christ said it was their lack of faith. God will act on our behalf to protect us if we have faith in him, if we place our trust in him and in his power. Now, as if faith and trust in God wasn't enough, God has given us another means by which we can turn Satan away. Humility. Now, humility, of course, goes hand in hand with faith. Turn over to James chapter 4. Mr. Beatles stole one of my scriptures, but that's okay. He didn't actually turn there, so I'll let him slide. James chapter 4. Pick it up in verse 7. "Therefore, submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he will lift you up. If we resist Satan, he will flee. If we draw near to God, he will draw near to us. We draw near to God through prayer and fasting, just as Christ told the disciples. You have to pray and fast. And then it says, let your laughter be turned to mourning. And isn't that interesting? Again, humility, not mocking. Mocking Satan won't turn him away. There's a famous quote from C.S. Lewis that many professing Christians use to justify the keeping of Halloween. "The devil, that proud spirit," this is the quote, "the devil, that proud spirit, cannot endure to be mocked." Well, no, if there's one thing Satan cannot endure, it's humble submission to God. He just doesn't understand it. As we've just read, if we resist Satan and humbly submit ourselves to God's authority, Satan is powerless to do anything. Humble submission to God means we shed our pride. It means we say, "Look, I've made some mistakes, and I'm sorry." It means we accept God's will. Maybe things haven't gone like we want, but we say, "That's okay. Not as I will, but as you will, God. Your will be done." In truth, the devil, that proud spirit, cannot endure humility. Now, another lie that Satan and the demons want us to believe. Spirit beings don't enjoy food or drink or other physical things. We see this very commonly in media. Satan likes to tell this lie that spirit beings just long to be physical. as if the things that we can experience are somehow so much better than if we were a spirit being. I mean, think about it. How could a spirit being enjoy the feel of sand between your toes, or the warmth of the sun? How about the smell after the rain, the smell of a wheat field in at the sunset? In reality, as spirit beings, our senses will be in tune perfectly. Now, as you know, Alicia can't smell, and she's been amazed that things like rain can have a smell, or how a wheat field could somehow smell any different at midday versus sunset, let alone smell better, right? But it does. Now, what use, really, does a spirit being have to do with smell? Turn over to Psalm 141. Psalm 141. Psalm of David, verse 1. Lord, I cry out to you. Make haste to me. Give ear to my voice when I cry out to you. Let my prayer be set before you as incense. We have here a picture of humble submission to God. Now, why would David compare his prayer to incense if it would be a metaphor lost on God? Well, it isn't, of course. God designed our senses. Everything physical that we enjoy has been designed by him. And as spirit beings, our senses will be perfectly tuned. Eternal life in God's kingdom is our reward, and Satan doesn't want us to be excited about it. When we think about being a spirit being, he wants us to go, but I wasn't done living my life yet. There's just so much more I wanted to experience. There is no physical experience that we can have in this life that compares at all to what it will be like to be members of the God family. There is nothing that, after being born into the family of God, we're going to look back and say, man, I really wish, I miss pizza or pumpkin pie. We're big pumpkin pie, pumpkin spice people. There's nothing that we will look back on and say we missed. You know, we're coming up to Thanksgiving, and I remember a couple years ago, we went up to Alicia's mom's house for Thanksgiving, and we had a great meal, you know, and we're sitting there like, oh, it's great, you know, but we did save some room for pumpkin pie. And she goes, I'm sorry, the what? I was like, the pie. We'll have the pumpkin pie now. And she said, oh, I didn't think anybody liked it, so I didn't make any. And we're like, that's... No, seriously, we'll have the pie now. No, there was no pie. But we missed the pie then, but as spirit beings, we're not going to miss the pumpkin pie. There's nothing we will miss about this physical life. Wine, for example. Christ at the Passover, he passed around the wine, and telling them to drink, and that he would not drink wine again until he drank it with us in God's kingdom. Why wine? Why not water? Why anything, really? Especially if we as spirit beings won't particularly enjoy it. The idea that spirit beings can't enjoy physical things is the complete opposite of the truth. Our senses are now dull, and as spirit beings, we will enjoy so much more. Our joy will be made full. Another scripture that Mr. Beadle stole, 1 Corinthians 2, verse 9. We don't have to turn there, but our eyes have not seen, nor have our ears heard, nor has it entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for those who love him. We simply can't even begin to imagine how wonderful it will be. So this idea that spirit beings long to be physical just simply isn't true. Well, it might be half true. It might be a third true. Anyway, one third of the angelic host really wishes they had what has been promised to us, to become members of God's family. Well, Satan wants us to focus on the physical instead of the glorious spiritual life that is awaiting us. And he wants us to think of spiritual life the same way they think about it. Turn over to Jude. Jude, and Notice what we have here in verse 12. These are spots in your love feasts, while they feast with you without fear, serving only themselves. They are clouds without water. What does a cloud without water do? It just brings darkness. They're carried about by the winds. They have no power or control over where they go. They are late autumn trees without fruit. What good is a tree with no leaves and no fruit in autumn? It's only good to be burned, really. They are twice dead. Well, Satan and the demons have been kicked out of heaven, and they will soon be locked up, twice dead. They're pulled up by the roots, raging waves of the sea, foaming up their own shame, wandering stars for whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever. This is how they view their existence. This is how they feel, and they lie to us to try to make us feel the same way. The word ghostly fairly well sums it up. They want us to have this idea that spiritual life is shallow, empty, meaningless, and void of joy. There are so many lies that Satan and the demons push on us. They are not grotesque, fearsome-looking creatures that they would believe, that they would have you believe. On the contrary, the angels of God are kind of magnificent beings, and they want us to be afraid of them instead of God. They want us to be fearful because they are fearful themselves. And while Satan and the demons are powerful beings, God is limited what they can do. They are not held back by anything physical or any utterance of words. They are restrained by the power of God, power that God has made available to us if we humble ourselves and draw near to him. As spirit beings ourselves, when we become spirit beings, we won't feel as though we've missed out on anything in this life. What God has prepared for us far exceeds anything that we could possibly experience in this life. Again, the important thing to remember is that Satan is the father of lies. He has many that he wants us to believe, all in an effort to get us to be distracted, to distance ourselves from God, and eventually give up our spiritual fight. Don't listen to his lies. Stay close to God. Resist him, and he will flee.